And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on, boy, all of a sudden, a wintry day this Wednesday. We have the goofiest weather over the next several days. I mean, it's wintertime out there today. The wind is blowing like crazy. Temperatures are now in the upper 20s, and we've had snow squalls and all kind of stuff. Much heavier snow, though, north of Butler along the I-80 corridor. They've been getting blasted all day today. In fact, they closed down Interstate 80 westbound for a while between Knox and Shippenville. And then later on this morning, about an hour ago, they reopened one lane. So it's a mess out there. Be careful if you're driving and you run into one of these snow squalls. We're nice and warm inside, though. I don't know about Amy Metrick. She's in Harrisburg at the State Farm Show. Are you nice and warm there, Amy, or are you chilly, too?
It's pretty chilly here. It's snowing away.
Well, we want to get an update from Amy Metrick, who oversees the 4-H program for Penn State Extension here in Butler County. And you had a number of our local 4-H'ers down at the State Farm Show, actually, I guess, over this past weekend. Is that right, Amy?
That's correct, yeah. Over from Friday to Tuesday, a lot of the junior exhibitors are at the Pennsylvania Farm Show. We had quite a few Butler kids attend. We had kids with chickens and rabbits and cattle. We had some pigs and sheep and goats, so we had everything covered very well, and they did very well as well.
So we had some winners of ribbons from our local 4-H'ers?
We did. We had Brooklyn Peters with her lamb. She got a first place. David Schulteis got a couple second places with his cattle. And we had a leader, Connie Dunn. She got grand champion with her fleece. And a family, the Miller family, Stacy and Brian Miller, whose kids are in 4-H as well, they were the premier limousine breeders here at the farm show.
Well, that's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, it's one thing to win a ribbon at the Butler Farm Show or the Big Butler Fair, but boy, at the State Farm Show, those ribbons, that's pretty good stuff, isn't it?
It is. These kids work hard. It's not as fun going out when it's cold and snowy and working with those animals, but they do it, and they do an excellent job.
So I'm guessing that they have many of the 4-H kids come in early in the farm show, which opened last Friday. That way they only have to miss a day or two of school because many of our local kids are already back here in Butler County, right?
Correct, yes. A lot of the shows happen over the weekend. For example, sheep showed on Saturday, pigs showed on Sunday, and goats showed on Monday. Chickens and rabbits showed all those days. Variation, and then they had their sale of champions on Tuesday. So those kids, like you said, only missed 2 days of school. We do have a few exhibitors on their way to the farm show right now. They are coming out with their breeding sheep, the Colchion family and the Miser family, along with Harold Dunn, who's a leader.
I hope they're careful on the roadways if they're traveling today, because it's pretty messy in many places with those snow squalls we got going.
Yes, for sure. Well, we told them the sun's shining here and it's just flaring, so they should be good.
A lot of people wonder why the State Farm Show is held in January when there's always a threat, usually a threat of bad weather. The reason is that's one of the few times of the year when farmers can take a day or two off and go to Harrisburg, right, Amy?
That's exactly right, yep. This farm show complex is 24 acres under roof. And it's 11 buildings, and they're all connected. And it's actually the largest indoor agricultural exhibits in the United States.
I've never actually been there. Is it right in the city of Harrisburg, or is it in the suburbs, or where is this huge complex anyway?
It is. It's right on the edge. You can, if you stand in the parking lot and look right, you can almost see the Capitol building. So not far from downtown at all.
Talking with Amy Metrick, who coordinates 4-H programs for Penn State Extension here in Butler County. She's in Harrisburg for the State Farm Show. Are you going to be there for the rest of the week? You are, because you have some special duties this year, don't you?
I do, yes. Our 4-H team for the state is in charge of our Pennsylvania 4-H booth. So myself and our co-chair, we set up the booth, and we got to take it down on Saturday. And my family volunteers with different things as well. Like, we're vegetable farmers, and we volunteer with the vegetable growers' food booth. And I also help a little bit with the junior committee for the State Farm Show. So we got many things to do to keep us busy this week.
Have you been going to the State Farm Show for a number of years, Amy? I know your father, Ken, has been very active in this. This is not the first time you've been there, right?
No, it is not. I have actually never missed one. In my 20-some years of life, I have been to every State Farm Show.
Wow. Well, that's something to look forward to, although coming as soon as it does, right after the holidays, Christmas and New Year's, it's probably a bit of a burden to get ready to head down there to Harrisburg for a week at this time of year.
It's definitely a busy time, and you got to think how you're going to do everything, but it's fun, and we enjoy it. It's we so-called family vacation, and we look forward to it every year.
Just a couple of more things before I let you go. Do they have the big butter sculpture again this year? That's always a big hit.
They do, yes, and this year it is based off of the different mascots for the sports teams in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. So Philly McBeam is made into Butler, along with a Philly Eagle, and I believe the Fanatic is what it is. So it's pretty neat, and it's supposed to represent how athletes refuel themselves by drinking milk.
One other thing that I've enjoyed watching on TV, because some of the farm show events are on the Pennsylvania cable network, it's the sheep to shawl competition. Do they still have that? I find that fascinating to watch.
They do, yes. It's actually going to be happening right now. The youth are competing for their sheep to shawl contest, and at 3:00 today, they will be doing the adult version of sheep to shawl.
And folks, if you've never seen this, they start out shearing a sheep, and by the end of the competition, they've taken care of the wool and spun it and made it into a shawl. It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty cool.
Amy, I know you're busy. Thanks for taking a couple of minutes out of your day to fill us in back home here on what's happening, especially with our young people at the State Farm Show. Good to talk with you, and safe travel when you're coming back this weekend.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. I appreciate it.
All righty. So long now.
Bye-bye.
Amy Metrick visiting with us live from Harrisburg. We didn't have the best of connections there, but sometimes happens, especially with the weather like we've got right now. Hey, there's more to come on It's Your Turn today. We're going to be take a quick break here, and then going to be talking with a man by the name of Mark Hartwig. And it's kind of topical because we have an election year coming up this year, presidential election year. He is worried about the future of America. And by the way, this is not an anti-conservative, anti-Republican, anti-Democratic thing, anti-Trump thing, pro-Trump thing. He's just worried about the state of American government. So we'll see what he has to say, hear what he has to say. He'll be visiting with us from southwest somewhere, Montana, Idaho. And we'll be chatting with Mark Hartwig coming up here on It's Your Turn in just a couple of minutes. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
I can't remember the last time I went to the dentist. Now I'm too embarrassed to go because my teeth are in such bad condition.
Unfortunately, this person is not alone. Many folks put off going to the dentist because they fear being scolded for neglecting their teeth. This is Dr. Bob Todd with a special message. Dentistry today is faster, easier, and better than ever before. At our dental office, we don't believe in making you feel guilty, no matter how long it has been since you've seen a dentist. We know fear and embarrassment can cause a cycle of procrastination. If it has been years since you've been to the dentist, call us today. We will help put your mind at ease and bring your smile back to health.
If you hate going to the dentist but know you have a dental problem, help is only a phone call away. Dr. Bob Todd and his friendly dental team will answer all your questions and care for all your concerns. For complimentary information or to schedule an appointment at their Butler office on Evan City Road, please call 282-7774 or on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Hey, here's a good way to beat the winter blahs. Get out of town for a few days. Why not take a trip with Butler Motor Tours? Butler Motor Tours, a local company. They're on South Monroe Street in Butler. They've been around for more than 75 years. And when you travel with Butler Motor Tours, you travel in comfort on one of their big motor coaches, their big cruisers. By the way, they always take trips down to Florida, too, in the winter months. So there's an idea to look at. If you want to check out their offerings, just go to their website. It's butlerbus.com. Butlerbus.com. All their upcoming trips are listed there with the dates and the itinerary and the cost and all of that. You can even book online if you so desire. And you can get gift certificates, too. Butler Motor Tours. Check them out online at butlerbus.com. That's Butler Motor Tours online at butlerbus.com. Going to be talking a little bit about the future of America and government. Listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is author Mark Hartwig, who joins us by telephone. Mark, the first thing I have to ask you is the correct pronunciation of your new book, because I'm unsure of where to put the accent. Can you pronounce it for me?
Yeah, well, sometimes I have the same problem. It's placebocracy.
Placebocracy, okay. So,
and other ailments, yeah.
Which is a mishmash, I guess, between placebo and democracy. Am I correct on that?
Just placebo and krasi. Krasi is Greek for government, so it's government by placebo.
Placebocracy and Other Ailments, and the subtitle of Mark's book is A Classical Liberal Take on America Today. You mention in your book that America was actually founded on the principles of classical liberalism. Could you expand on that a little bit, Mark? What do you mean by that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, the first thing I would say is that it shouldn't be confused with what we coin as liberalism today. They're two different things. Classical liberalism, in essence, is the idea that you have government as a democracy, but that people are cognizant of not only their rights within that system, but also their obligations. John Adams put it, one of the primary obligations of constituents of a democracy are to be educated, to understand the system, to understand what those rights and obligations are. In essence, the classical liberal standpoint is that we don't avail ourselves of government except for the necessities such as national defense and the like, and that we take responsibility for ourselves to the extent possible. And we don't ask the state to intervene in every aspect of our life to see to our needs. Now, it's a little bit like libertarianism, but the libertarians tend to go, well, look, the government shouldn't be involved in anything, not in national defense, not this, not that, and it's a little bit ludicrous. I think it's a subversion of what classical liberalism actually is. Classical liberalism recognizes the need for government.
And we should point out straight away here, folks, that Mark Hartwig swears no allegiance to any political party. I mean, you rip both Democrats and Republicans in your book, right?
Yeah, I do. I'm not partisan when it comes to that. I think that we've gone down the garden path on this one. I think that our loyalty should be to ideas and not parties or people in terms of politics.
Well, how do you feel that America can escape this danger of failing that you're talking about? Does it start with the changes in our educational system for young people?
Yeah, I think it really does. I think that there have been a lot of polls taken over the course of the last decade that indicate clearly that young people don't have a clue how the system works. They don't understand the separation of powers. They don't understand the rights and obligations. They don't really know anything about the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. And I think that's problematic. The other problem is that our educational system somewhere in the 50s or 40s moved away from teaching critical thinking towards trying to develop a malleable population. And I think to some extent feed anticipated labor markets. So really it starts with education. It starts with people having a broad-based education, history, geography, civics, as well as maths and sciences and English and probably another language. But the critical thing is that they learn how to think. You've got to learn how to apply your knowledge and filter it through prior knowledge and come up with answers for yourself. And the only way that that can happen is if they're educated to do that, and in historical terms, to be able to put history into context. We hear a lot today about how terrible these people were in the past, particularly the founders. But there's absolutely no understanding of the context. I mean, for example, I would dare you to find a kid that could answer whether or not John Adams had a position on slavery. And he did, very much so. You know, he was adamantly against it, but recognized that he couldn't make it part of the American Revolution or anything that subsequently followed within his lifetime because he would have had no support for the revolution.
Might not be able to find too many kids who knew that John Adams was the second president of the United States, for that matter.
Well, you're probably right. They probably think he's a guy down at the gas station or something. I don't know. I think you're right, and that's part of the problem. And if you don't know where you come from, it's kind of hard to understand how you've come to be in the present and where you're going to go in the future, I think. I don't know. It might have been Churchill or somebody who said that past is prologue, and I think it's certainly true.
You mentioned lack of understanding of even such basic principles as the separation of powers. It surprises me. I'm a baby boomer, Mark, and when I was in high school, I had one entire semester, one half of a year, where we studied nothing but civics. Nothing but civics.
Yeah.
First, the federal government.
Public school in Canada, and we were taught American public civics.
I guess that a lot of school districts don't teach that anymore. I guess. I'm not sure.
No, they simply don't. They don't teach it, and this is the problem. I mean, what's taught in school in a historical context, it's not taught in context, but it's the blame game. Well, the founders were bad people because some of them had slaves, or this and that, but nobody's taught context. Nobody's taught the underpinnings of what led to the American Revolution. That would require them to read people like John Locke, who was an English philosopher who was basically the father of modern classical liberalism and the modern idea of a democratic state. But no, they're not taught. They simply don't learn any of those things.
We are in an election year now, 2020, national election, presidential election coming up. You say in your book that this will be a major turning point in our nation's history and future. Expand on that a little bit, Mark Hartwig.
Okay. Little difficult. It's not about Trump, as many people like to say it is. I think that Trump, and I maintain this throughout, and I believe it firmly, that Trump is not a problem. He's a symptom of a problem. We see people in Trump's election that move towards his way of thinking, and subsequently in the midterms we saw people move towards the far left. And I think that's where the problem is. It's unless we recognize that we need to do something to deal with middle class angst because it's shrinking, because people, in spite of being employed, no longer have enough money to meet their needs. If we don't come to that realization and act on it as a country, then we'll see the country polarize more significantly over time, and particularly in these elections. Now, I don't think necessarily that the Democrats have fielded anybody yet, but it's hard to say. I mean, it's a fluid situation. But I do think that there are earmarks that if we head further into economic malaise, and I think that's happening in spite of the low unemployment figures, then the country will simply polarize more, and there will be a larger group of people that simply stay home and don't participate.
A little bit more about our guest listeners, Mark Hartwig, author of Plutocracy and Other Ailments, has a law degree. He also has a degree in international relations. He practiced law up through a year or so ago, but my goodness, I look at your biography, Mark, and you've done a lot of stuff. You were active in the commercial maritime industry. You worked as an oil spill response coordinator, an investigator, a forest fighter, a forest firefighter, a ranch hand. You've had quite an interesting life.
Well, I have. It's been fun. It was hard. I tell my kids not to follow the same path, but I think what it gave me is different perspectives from different walks of life. that I sort of accumulated as I rolled through life. But yes, I've had a pretty diverse background.
We'll pause for a minute or two here, listeners. We'll pick up our conversation with our guest, Mark Hartwig, here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way, getting there starts here. Just hop the bus, easy and economical. Just hop the bus, no car, no problem. The bus will get you there, 'cause that's what we do. Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey, and on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, we chat via the telephone with guest Mark Hartwig, author of Placebocracy and Other Ailments, a classical liberal take on America today. And if you're just joining us, once again, when Mark refers to classical liberal take, he's not talking about the way we might use liberal today. We're talking about classical liberalism back from the start of the country. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the things you discuss in your book, including why we do not have a fully functioning free market society. You say socialist policies could undermine the nation. Talk about that a little bit, Mark Hartwig.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think the first thing is that we have been bound up in discussions of economics by saying that capitalism and socialism or communism are antithetical to each other, and I disagree with that. I think there's only one economic system, and that's capitalism. And I think that, and I'll try to make this simple, I think that capitalism in the various forms of capitalism can be distinguished from each other simply by determining how much centralized degree there is, whether it's corporate or government, over the factors of production. And the factors of production are land, money, resources, information, and that kind of thing. And I think the problem in this country is we attribute many of its problems, or many people do, to market capitalism, and we don't have a market capitalist system. Most of the resources in this country are either held by the government or by a very small percentage of large corporations and individuals. So at the outset, we're not a market capitalist country. The government interferes in the marketplace to the extent that it protects companies. We had too big to fail. When the banking crisis hit, we continue to do that. We continue to subsidize agriculture. We continue to subsidize any manner of corporations. And it's not just sometimes it's through preferential treatment. Other times it's through subsidy, rigged contract bids, that kind of thing. And I think that the first thing we have to understand is that we're more down the road towards socialism by virtue of doing those things, and we probably should revisit the idea of moving more towards the market system.
Once again, Mark Hartwig rips into all parties, conservatives, liberals, even the news media in his book. In fact, one of your chapters is about how traditional media is becoming irrelevant. Well, if that's the case, Mark, what will replace traditional media?
Well, I think it's a scary thing. I mean, there's a little experiment being done by the Salt Lake Daily, the Tribune, I think it's called, and they convert it to a 501c3, a nonprofit, and we'll see what happens with that. But I think the real problem with media is that it has moved into the field of advocacy. And I remember, as you probably do, back when CBS had Walter Cronkite, and they would give you the news. It was relatively balanced. And then Cronkite would say, well, here is my opinion. And that's fair. But I think the problem now is that we can no longer distinguish between what's advocacy within the news, particularly politically, and what is actual news. So what's the future? I think the future is that the media, first of all, is the worst enemy of the First Amendment. I think they're opening the door towards being challenged as actually being independent media in the courts, and that started to happen. And so what do? We rely on social media. Well, the accuracy of that is highly debatable, as we all know. So I'm not quite sure where we go.
You advocate for a stronger, bigger middle class. You mentioned that earlier in our conversation. But you also say that we don't know how to define the middle class. This is a term that's tossed around by politicians of every party. You think we need to redefine the term middle class?
Sure. Well, right now, middle class is used in a variety of contexts. But if you take a look at it realistically, the middle class is nothing more than an economic term. It's the group of people that make somewhere, I think it's between $24,000 or $25,000 to $60,000 or $70,000 a year, economically so defined, taxed accordingly, treated that way under the tax code, and so on and so forth. The problem is it's nonsense. If you have a family of four, for example, two parents, two kids, both parents working, and they're earning $60,000 a year, they're characterized as being in the middle class, and that's simply ridiculous, because the average necessity for a family of four in this country is somewhere around $68,000. So how are they in the middle class? They're in the poverty class because they can't meet their needs. I think the real problem is that people, the polls especially, don't recognize that the middle class isn't a cohesive group except as it's defined arbitrarily. They're doctors, they're lawyers, plumbers, electricians, school teachers, carpenters. So what holds them together besides wanting economic stability? They vote for economic stability when they feel it. When they no longer feel it, then they move in different directions. And that's the problem we're facing right now, and that's what led, I think, to Trump's election.
Some of the thoughts that you expand on in your book are eye-opening. You have a chapter that advocates for the disbandment of Congress in its current form. Do you really mean that, Mark, or are you just stimulating
discussion?
No, I
think that Congress has disbanded itself in terms of meeting its obligations under the Constitution. Look, Congress is supposed to make laws, and they dither and dally about. They don't do anything except find new ways to spend money in pork barrel. The greatest example is the DACA or the Dreamers situation. You know, the kids that were born here of people that weren't legal immigrants. Obama asked them to legislate. What should I do with them? Congress refused, so Obama basically mandated that they could stay. Trump did the same thing. He said, give me legislation on how to deal with them. Congress refused, so Trump is talking about not letting them stay. The real problem is that it's Congress's job to do that. And Congress is more concerned on both sides, and in the Senate and the House, with re-election. So to support the idea of allowing people who are latently illegals to stay in the country, a lot of the politicians are going, well, no, I don't want to touch that because I won't get re-elected. They don't want to do the hard stuff. And they certainly don't want to deal with deficit issues. I mean, they just spent another over $1 trillion they approved in spending without any thought to where the money's going to come from to pay for it.
It wasn't all that long ago when the national debt was a big political issue. Doesn't seem to be anymore.
No. Now the issue is how much they can spend. I mean, we've even got people talking about building trains to Europe because they should ban airplanes. It's ridiculous. At some point, you've got to pay the piper. And I think the problem is that the culture of debt that the government's adopted has trickled down to the individual consumer. We all live in debt. We're a debtor nation comprised of constituencies who are in debt.
Public trust in our institutions is declining. It's at an all-time low. Everybody admits this. How do we begin to address the problems of corruption in government? You say election reform would be a good start, huh?
Yeah, I do. I think the Supreme Court made a fundamental mistake when they, back in the day, when they came up with the notion that somehow corporations have the same rights as individuals. I think it's kind of nonsensical. But the real problem is it's a money game. There's too much money involved in elections to the extent where now you can only have people with a lot of money running, or with the support of people with a lot of money, and it calls from the potential candidates people who might be talented, might know what they're doing, might be good at the job, but have no hope of getting in because there's too much money involved in the elections process. I think that's one starting point. I think the other problem is that we still have this nefarious relationship between large corporate entities and elected officials. I think that conflicts of interest laws should be firmed up to the point where there simply is no way that a sitting politician at the present or some years after not being elected should be allowed to avail themselves of any jobs or perks or board memberships in corporations that make campaign contributions.
One final question, Mark Hartwig. Do you think Donald Trump will be reelected this year, or would you prefer not to speculate?
You know, I don't really want to speculate, but I will go this far. He managed to do it once, and I think unless somebody comes into the fray that really understands the media and the constituents the way he does, I think he has a shot of getting reelected. I think that there is a disconnect between the politicians in D.C. and the constituencies of this country that they don't really understand how he got elected, and so it's going to be difficult for them to overcome that. That said, who knows? I mean, I don't advocate for either side. I think that it really, at the end of the day, doesn't make any difference.
The title of the book is Plusocracy and Other Ailments, A Classical Liberal Take on America Today. The author, our guest, Mark Hartwig, HARTWIG. Nice to talk with you today, Mark. Thanks for being with us.
Likewise, David. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Sure. So long now.
Tobacco for Less is Western PA's largest glass emporium, and they now have a store in Butler at Pullman Square Plaza. What makes Tobacco for Less different from other stores? For starters, they have so many glass pipes to choose from. They also feature a walk-in humidor and a vape juice bar. And of course, they carry a variety of standard tobacco products too. The Tobacco for Less Health and Wellness Department stocks a large selection of high-quality CBD products. For all your smoking and vaping needs, check out Tobacco for Less with locations in Butler, Sharon, and Aliquippa.
A special message at Christmas and holiday time from the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. They would not only like to wish you and yours a very, very merry and holy Christmas and a happy new year, but also to say thanks. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all of those who have supported them in their efforts during the past year. Thanks to those of you who donated to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul thrift store, to those of you who patronized the thrift store. All the proceeds there go to help fund the food cupboard and the client aid program. And thanks to those of you who donated provisions to the food cupboard throughout the year. And thanks to those of you, too, who donated extra produce from your garden during the harvest season to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul food cupboard. Thank you so much. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all of you and yours from the Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Butler.
Do you have your tickets for WISR's Butler County Wine Festival? If not, here's just a sampling of the fun you'll be missing. Samples from Pennsylvania wineries and distilleries, food samples including cheese balls, dips, pastries, dipping mustards, roasted nuts, wine slushies, chocolate, and more. Shopping with our specialty food and merchandise vendors who offer everything from jewelry, beauty and skincare products to kitchen gadgets, ethnic food, essential oils, and home decor. There'll be a huge basket raffle with wine accessories, gourmet food items, and more that benefits the March of Dimes. The festival is presented by WISR and Deal Toyota on January 25th at the Butler Days Inn. The $20 advance ticket also includes a souvenir wine tasting glass and a food voucher for our refreshment booth. Choose from two sessions, 2 to 5 or 6 to 9. Tickets are limited for each session, so get yours today at butlerradio.com. Attention Alexa users, did you know you can listen to WISR through your Amazon Echo? That's right. Alexa, play WISR.
Playing WISR.
WISR is proud to provide you with the music you love on the devices you use. Radio, computer, tablet, smartphone, and now your Amazon Alexa-enabled device. WISR, we're everywhere you are. Just ask Alexa.
Are you 65 years of age? Did you know you are eligible to ride free transportation? That's right, free transportation. Sign up for your free transit pass at Butler Transit Authority's downtown bus terminal on West Newcastle Street. Ride the local Butler buses to shopping, destinations, medical appointments, and more. Feeling more adventurous? Take the bus to Pittsburgh. Shop, dine, and explore all that Pittsburgh has to offer. Visit our bus terminal or butlertransit.com for more information.
Listeners, welcome, first of all, on this segment of It's Your Turn. Nice to have you with us. Dave Malarkey is my name, if you're joining us a little bit late. We're going to be talking about two of the most well-known names in American history today. One is Mark Twain, the other is Theodore Roosevelt. Our guest visits with us by telephone. He is author Philip McFarland. Mr. McFarland, nice to meet you. I'm glad we're able to talk for a few minutes here today.
Well, I'm very, very pleased to be with you.
We want to talk about your book. The title is Mark Twain and the Colonel. Subtitle, Samuel Clemens, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Arrival of a New Century. Well, let's talk a little bit about this era, and we're about 100 years back in history. What some people may not realize, they may remember years ago when we were getting ready to enter a new millennium, how everyone was all fired up about that, and it was, oh, wow, we're going out of the 1900s and into the 2000s. The same thing was happening 100 years ago, wasn't it, whenever we turned the previous century?
That's part of why I got interested in writing the book, because I think many of us at the time wondered what was going on 100 years ago. I knew that my mother had been a child back then, and that my grandmother was a young housewife, and I knew something about her life, my grandmother's life, because we used to visit her in southern Ohio a great deal when I was young, and she lived to be 91, so I knew her well, although she set up housekeeping way back in the times we were just speaking of, toward the beginning of end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century.
You mention, Philip, in your book, Mark Twain and the Colonel, two watershed events that occurred right around the turn of the century and which continued to influence Americans for the better part of the next 100 years. One of them was the separate but equal Supreme Court decision, right?
The Supreme Court decision in 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson, and that declared legal the whole idea of segregating the black race from the white race, and what was to be provided was separate but equal accommodations, schools, restaurants, and so on. Of course, as it developed, the possibility of it being equal was just non-existent. The segregation in the South continued, and to some extent, unofficially, to a fairly large extent, unofficially in the North, but officially in the South, the Jim Crow laws that segregated the black race from the white race continued until 1954.
Yes, we lived under that.
They were declared unconstitutional by Brown versus Education.
Mm-hmm. And then the civil rights legislation came the following decade. The other major event, and boy, for a lot of us, it was an eye-opener for me. When I was reading your book, I had forgotten about that. The United States has been a world power for so long, and since the collapse of the former Soviet Union, the one significant world power, but we were not for the first 100 years or so of our existence. We really became a world power only because of war around the turn of the century, around 1900.
Yes, that was in 1898. It was not a long war. It was a very brief war of 2 weeks where we fought the Spanish remove them from Cuba, which was 95 miles off our coast, and where there was an insurgency that had been going on for years and years to throw off the Spanish yoke. And finally, through a succession of events, we got involved in that and successfully prosecuted the war, making Theodore Roosevelt a national hero, giving him his title, Colonel, which he which he adored above all others, adored it above the title of President Roosevelt. He was more proud of that than he was of any other of the many titles he earned in his lifetime. As a result of the war, we almost inadvertently gained possession of the Philippine Islands, and not knowing quite what to do with them, they had been under the Spanish yoke for 300 years. We first thought we would just have take one of the islands to provide coal for the ships, for our ships that were sailing to the Far East, coaling station. But in the end, we took the whole archipelago, and the result was a great divisive issue in the United States. Those who were pro-acquiring this foreign colony and those who were against it. Mark Twain was very much against it, as were many other distinguished names of the time, but the great sentiment of the American people at large was for acquiring what Mark Twain insisted was an empire in imitation of the European powers, which at the time were busily acquiring empires of their own in Indochina and Africa and Asia.
We're talking, for listeners who may have joined us a few minutes late on this segment of It's Your Turn. Welcome, Dave Mullarkey is my name. Our guest visits with us by telephone today. He is historian and author Philip McFarland. We're talking about his latest book, Mark Twain and the Colonel. Well, we've mentioned how Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, ties into this picture with America becoming a national power. He, of course, was a war hero from the Spanish-American War. 3 years later, he's president. How does Mark Twain fit in at this time of in our history around the turn of the century? Mark Twain actually had been living abroad, hadn't he, for the better part of 10 years, Philip?
That's right. He had suffered economic reverses. He had invested a great deal of money in a machine to set type, and it had proved an impractical machine. After all, the expense and the time spent developing it, so that he lost all his money and had to retire from his mansion in Hartford, Connecticut, and sail abroad, where he lived from June 1891 until October 1900. When he returned from overseas, he got back just at the as we were entering an election era. In fact, we were just weeks from the election of 1900, which put William McKinley back into the White House for a second term, and in the course of the time that remained, McKinley acquired this Philippine Islands extension of the American holdings, and before he became or he fell to the assassin's bullet in 1901, and Roosevelt by then was propelled to the White House because he was McKinley's vice president.
And he took over.
That's how Roosevelt got to the White House. He was the youngest that we've ever had before or since who entered the White House. He was 42 years old, and he was very much for acquiring Philippines as a protectorate of the United States. What Mark Twain was objecting to was that this was betraying all of the American ideals. You govern by the consent of the governed, and the Filipinos had not given that consent. You treated everybody as equals. Of course, we always have to accept at the time the blacks, but who were not the African Americans, who were not being treated equally. They were being shamefully discriminated against. But the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence had values in them that said we treated everybody equally, and the Filipinos were not being treated equally. They were being treated as subjects. Mm-hmm. So Mark Twain objected to that. America was a continental nation that ended at the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans, and here we were violating that understanding for the first time, acquiring lands 7,000 miles away, and people who knew nothing about our values of freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, trial by jury, and so on, who were of a different religion. They were Roman Catholic. They spoke a different language, Spanish, and so on.
Let me take a quick break here. Our time begins to run short. We have a few more minutes that we can chat with Philip McFarland, but I have to take a quick break here and sneak in a message or two. We'll be back to continue our conversation here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words. The Spencer D. Geibel Funeral Home and Cremation Services, located at 140 Newcastle Road. It's about halfway up Newcastle Hill, just down from the State Police Barracks. This is the Butler area's newest funeral home, Spencer D. Geibel Funeral Home, the first and only value-designed funeral home built specifically for that purpose. A funeral home that offers styles, types, and levels of service that others are not able or willing to offer. They can transfer all prearranged funeral services and policies as well. It's an entirely new idea. It's local. And there's a hometown gentleman running the operation, Spencer D. Geibel. Spencer D. Geibel Funeral Home and Cremation Services, 140 Newcastle Road in Butler. Not affiliated with any other funeral home. Welcome back, listeners. My name is Dave Malarkey. If you're joining us a little bit late on It's Your Turn, we're talking this segment with historian and author Philip McFarland. We're talking about his book, Mark Twain and the Colonel. We've heard a good bit about the background, and it took us a while to set the stage for the real meat and potatoes of Philip McFarland's book. First of all, these two men, although they disagreed philosophically on a number of issues, as you have explained, Philip, they knew each other. They were... In fact, they were very well acquainted, were they not?
They were, and Mark Twain was much impressed by Roosevelt as a human being. He said, "Mr. Roosevelt is one of the most likable men that I am acquainted with." And Mark Twain was acquainted with just about everybody. Who wouldn't want to be the friend of Mark Twain's? And Roosevelt, like everybody else, admired Mark Twain enormously and had no idea of Roosevelt's private thoughts about Mark Twain's private thoughts about Roosevelt in the White House.
So they didn't speak publicly about their differences.
No, never. They conducted themselves with great decorum, but there was a time when Roosevelt said he would like to skin Mark Twain alive, and since Roosevelt was taxidermically sophisticated, he shot birds as a child and learned to stuff them. He was a great ornithologist as a young man, and so when he talked about skinning somebody alive, you took it a little seriously. But what he was objecting to was what Mark Twain had written about the missionaries abroad in the Far East who Mark Twain had no use for. He felt missionaries shouldn't be, I don't know, we need to get into this, but he felt missionaries shouldn't be persuading children about beliefs and so on, and that, once again, that we shouldn't be meddling in foreign lands, and Roosevelt felt differently about that. But generally, Roosevelt admired Mark Twain enormously. He loved Huckleberry Finn, he loved Tom Sawyer, he loved Life on the Mississippi, and he was delighted to have Mark Twain as a friend. And every time Mark Twain met Roosevelt, he said, every time he shook his hand, an electric charge ran up his arm, and he was an irresistible human being. But he did feel that Roosevelt, as chief executive, was leading us down the wrong path. path and was leading us into empire, and democracy and empire don't mix. And that was his major stumbling block and what led him to write that Roosevelt was, and this is a quote, was far and away the worst president we have ever had. He didn't want that read until he had been dead 100 years when he authorized it in his autobiography. But in fact, it came into print in 1940, 60 years early or 50 years early, and while many of the Roosevelts were still alive, and they were very hurt to hear what Mark Twain had written about their adored father and husband.
Were both of these men we hear many times about people who are very well known today who were not so during their lifetimes, but that was not the case with these two men. They were both celebrated, they were both famous, they were both extremely well known at the time, were they not?
That's an interesting point, and that is absolutely true. Of course, Roosevelt, as a politician, had a great many who were opposed to him, enemies professionally, but Mark Twain had almost none, except when he took this anti-imperialistic stance. And then there were some who objected to that because they considered him unpatriotic, and yet they excused it because they thought of him as a humorist and didn't take him seriously, which vexed him a good bit. But you're quite right that both Mark Twain and Roosevelt were extremely well known and well liked during their lifetime, and their reputation remains, if anything, higher than it was at the time of their death.
Philip, I must mention, our time begins to run short here, but I must mention some of your previous works, because this book that we're talking about today, listeners, Mark Twain and the Colonel, is simply the latest in a distinguished series, actually, of American biographies and histories by Philip McFarlane. And as I look down through the list of your previous books, boy, I see two or three of them that I'd love to read. Are all of these still in print, Philip?
Well, certainly the book on Hawthorne and the book on Harriet Beecher Stowe would be, and I assume the book on the American Revolution called The Brave Bostonians.
Well, those were exactly
still be in print.
Those were the three that I were looking at.
Others could be found in online at used book places, I'm told, because people every now and then ask me about it, and I guide them to that, and they return with a smile on their face, so I assume they found it. But I can't speak for the books that came out quite a while ago. But in any case, I'm grateful for your mention, and it was because I had written the book on Hawthorne and on Harriet Beecher Stowe that I thought a nice companion volume on Mark Twain would be would fit in quite well as we move through the 19th century into what was then our own century. I started the book in 1999 or so, this current book. That was what got me to write to the subject of Mark Twain. And then I came upon that remarkable judgment of one of our great presidents, that he was the worst we've ever had, and I wondered why Mark Twain thought that way. And when I pursued it, I spent a long time researching and writing the book, and I became just absolutely absorbed with how up-to-date all of those issues that were being dealt with at the time remain to us today.
Absolutely. And the two central characters
Absolutely. They are totally absorbing. They had an opinion on every issue, every subject of the time, and could express their thoughts so articulately and so vividly. It was just a joy. And they took different viewpoints on a whole lot of the issues, so you got quite a comprehensive understanding of the issues and the fascinating characters of the time: Rockefeller, Carnegie, Morgan, the Wright brothers, Henry Ford, George Westinghouse, Edison, all of these run through the book.
And all of this happening at approximately the same time, toward the end of, right before and right after the turn of the century, the
1900s. That's right. Uh-huh.
Fascinating time. These two men, Mark Twain and Theodore Roosevelt, remain of great interest today to most Americans. They're certainly well-known figures to most Americans.
I should think so. I should think Mark Twain may be the most beloved American who's ever lived. I don't know any other except maybe Benjamin Franklin, and we associate him with years before the United States was formed. I don't know any other American who, when I mention I'm writing a book about him, people come to life and say, I love Mark Twain. I just love Mark Twain. And I think that's pretty true as I cast my mind over the people who have formed our history. I don't know of anyone who remains more loved than Mark Twain and Theodore Roosevelt, given the issues that we're living through right now, remains very vital and alive.
And I'm sure many people like me did not realize that these two great men, great celebrities of their day, were well acquainted with each other. You can read more about it. Believe me, folks, we're just scratching the surface here with our conversation with Philip McFarland. The title of his book, again, is Mark Twain and the Colonel. Let me give you the titles, the two other ones that we were talking about. The Harriet Beecher Stowe book, the title is Loves of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and the Hawthorne book, the title is Hawthorne in Concord. Just a word or two about our guest. Philip McFarland was born in Alabama, Birmingham. He graduated from Phillips Exeter Academy, majored in history then at Oberlin. Then you served for several years in the U.S. Navy, 3.5 years in the Navy, and then a degree in English at Cambridge. Most interesting to talk about your book, Mark Twain and the Colonel. Thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, so long now.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
I wake up from something that keeps knocking at my brain. Before I go insane, I hold my pillow to my head and spring up in my bed, screaming out the words I dread. I think I love you.
I think I love you.
This morning I woke up with this feeling I didn't know how to deal with, and so I just decided to myself I'd hide it to myself and never talk about it, and did not go and shout it when you walked into the room. I think I love you.
I think I love you.
So what am I so afraid of? I'm afraid that I'm not sure of a love there is no cure for. I think I love you. Isn't that what life is made of? That I'd never felt this way.
I don't know what I'm up against. I don't know what it's all about. I got so much to think about.
Say
don't have to worry. I only want to make you happy. And if you say, hey, go away, I will. But I think better still, I'd better stay around and love you. Do you think I have a case? Let me ask you to your face. Do you think you love me?
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going well, the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going well, the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze. And skipping over the ocean like a stone. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's